I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A ruling this week in the U.S. Supreme Court could have big implications for property seizures in criminal cases in Kansas, Missouri, and across the country. Today, a conversation with one of the attorneys who handled the case and a constitutional expert. We'll examine the case that put all 50 states on notice about what property they can and can't keep. For some jurisdictions, it could mean a real drop in revenue. Then it's Oscar time. Well, almost. The indie foreign and documentary film critics are in. We're going to dive into the ever-popular short film categories and get a rundown of what's showing now on area screens, including a legal tale set on the mean streets of Beirut. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Tyson Timms was a small-time drug offender in Indiana who was arrested for selling a small amount of heroin to an undercover officer. State officials also seized Mr. Timms' $40,000 Land Rover, saying he had used it to commit crimes. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in and ruled that this was an overreach and essentially put every state on notice when it comes to keeping a defendant's personal property and the longstanding practice of what critics have described as policing for profit. With us to talk about this case, Edward Cantu is an associate professor of law at UMKC. Edward, nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Sam Gedge is an attorney at the Institute for Justice and was co-counsel on the Timms versus Indiana case, which the Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday. He worked for Tyson Timms. Sam, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Sam, give us the summary of how your client, Tyson Timms, was relieved of his $40,000 Land Rover.
Sure. So Tyson lives in rural Indiana, and for a number of years, he was addicted to heroin. He'd initially been prescribed a drug for foot pain, and that had escalated to heroin abuse. In the winter of 2012, his dad died. And as part of a life insurance policy, Tyson got about $70,000 in life insurance proceeds. He spent about $40,000 of that lawful money on a new car on his Land Rover. A couple of months after that, though, a confidential informant set Tyson up to do a very small drug sale to undercover cops. Tyson wasn't a drug dealer, but he was poor and addicted and desperate. And based on a sale of 4 grams of heroin, the police arrested him and convicted him, which is fine. But also, they seized his new $40,000 Land Rover.
He pleaded guilty. Do I have that right?
That's right. He pleaded guilty to one of the controlled substances offenses. And separately from that, though, the state proceeded through this mechanism of civil forfeiture.
What was his punishment?
He's had something like 5 years probation, a bit of house arrest, and he had to pay about $1,200 in kind of a hodgepodge of fees and costs.
Okay, so sort of bearing down on this particular case a little bit, why did the state keep the car?
Well, they kept it. Legally, the reason they kept it is because Indiana, like virtually every other state, has a mechanism for civil forfeiture, which empowers law enforcement to take people's cash, their cars, their homes, any property that the government claims is linked to a criminal offense. So here the state said that Tyson had driven across his small town to meet the cops to sell 2 grams of heroin. So because his car had that link to a crime, the state could take the car.
And just so I have this right, Sam, this practice of the authorities seizing property in connection with instances like this involving the sale of illegal drugs, this has been going on for a while, right?
It has. It's really a widespread phenomenon at the federal level and at the state level and even at the local level. You see police and prosecutors taking homes, taking cars, taking really any kind of property you can imagine, and doing it in many instances to punish not necessarily the person who committed the crime with the property, but ending up punishing people who owned the property but who had no connection to the crime at all.
You know, I think a lot of citizens out there probably aren't aware that the government at all levels has been doing stuff like this for so many years.
It's really surprising. It's kind of the dirty secret of the criminal justice system. Civil forfeiture has, you know, a long history back to like medieval times when you saw government seizing pirate ships and stuff like that. But it's really exploded over the past few decades with the war on drugs. And one of the things that really fuels it in many states and at the federal level is that the same police and prosecutors who are deciding whether to take your property are the agencies that stand to benefit financially from doing just that.
And just a minute ago, just so I heard you right, Sam, you're saying that in some cases, entire homes are seized?
Yes, it's certainly not uncommon. We represented a family in Philadelphia, and that the parents, of course, owned the home. But their teenage son sold a small quantity of drugs on the sidewalk outside, and Philadelphia police just sealed the house and would have taken it on the theory, not that the parents had done anything wrong, but that it was the site of a crime and was basically fair game.
You know, just a couple more things, and then I want to bring Edward into our conversation. How did this case wind up at the Institute for Justice?
So we were alerted by a friend of ours in Indiana when the Indiana Supreme Court's decision came down. That was in November of 2017. And the Indiana Supreme Court, just briefly, said that the excessive fines clause, which is a protection against excessive fines, doesn't apply at all to state governments. And when we saw that, it really jumped out as an issue that was kind of shocking and one that we thought the U.S. Supreme Court would be interested in.
And the Indiana Supreme Court had overruled a couple of lower courts, right?
That's exactly right. So the trial court in Tyson's hometown had said that, you know, taking his $42,000 car would be excessive compared to the gravity of his offenses. The Indiana Court of Appeals agreed. But the Indiana Supreme Court basically said, you know, we don't care whether or not this is excessive. The Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause just doesn't put any check at all on the power of state and local law enforcement to take people's property.
So your Institute for Justice saw a legal issue here that might be of interest to the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. You know, we're a nonprofit law firm. We specialize in various constitutional issues, among them property rights issues like civil forfeiture. So this really jumped out as kind of a surprisingly unresolved question. And one that had generated a split in authority in the lower courts and really seemed like it would be a good candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court's review.
Okay. Well, Edward Cantu, again from UMKC in the law school there, you know, how unusual is it for a case like this to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, not from a federal court, but from a state court like this one was?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court does reserve for itself the right to review state court decisions, but only from state supreme courts, not state lower courts, their decisions on constitutional issues or any other issue related to federal law. As far as the statistical frequency of it, I'm not quite sure. But
It's not frequent, though.
No,
is it?
It's not. A vast majority of cases that the Supreme Court agrees to hear are appeals from the lower federal courts, federal appellate courts.
And Sam, you were arguing this was an excessive fine, and explain that to us.
Sure. So the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides that the federal government cannot impose cruel and unusual punishments, but it also provides that the government can't impose excessive fines. And back in the 90s, the U.S. Supreme Court said that when the government is taking your property through forfeiture and is trying to punish you by doing that, that that's covered by the excessive fines clause when the federal government is doing it. So the open question, though. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Ed.
I was just going to say that the open question is whether that also applied to the states.
So, Edward, the Constitution has never forbidden the seizure of property, right?
Correct. At least according to the Supreme Court, correct.
Okay.
Which is a big caveat.
Right. Okay. Sam, was the state able to prove that Mr. Tim's $40,000 Land Rover was used in this crime?
So there was really no dispute that he had driven it on one occasion to one small level drug deal. So as a statutory matter under Indiana state law, the car qualified for forfeiture. What the trial court said was that, you know, there's a higher law. There's the U.S. Constitution. And regardless of whether they could take it as a matter of state statute, it would be excessive to do so under the Eighth Amendment.
You know, Edward, I'm wondering to what extent the ruling in this case by the U.S. Supreme Court surprised you.
It surprised me to the extent that I think the Supreme Court in this particular context has been glaringly absent in correcting injustice. Who knows the reason, exact reason why? Perhaps because some pretty problematic precedent has at least ostensibly settled the issue. Perhaps because this is such a cash cow for jurisdictions that the Supreme Court doesn't want to mess with that too much. Who knows what the reason is? So I was surprised to that extent. I wasn't surprised at the limited nature of the opinion. I think it's easy. This is a common phenomenon for people to perhaps overread what the Supreme Court says. This was not a devastating blow to this problematic practice of civil asset forfeiture.
That's going to continue here.
But it is a step toward putting some kind of check on abuses of it. The only thing the court said here is that the excessive fines clause is incorporated through the 14th Amendment and applies to the states. And that limitation of excessive fines applies specifically to the context of civil asset forfeiture. It did not really give much guidance as to what an excessive fine actually is.
That'll have to be worked out on
a case-by-case basis. It just remanded to the lower courts to figure out what that means in this case.
You know, I remember as a young pup, when I first came to town, I was assigned to the police department to report for the Kansas City Star, and learning about this civil forfeiture idea and hearing about cars being turned over to the police and that kind of thing. And I remember even as, you know, in my late 20s thinking, boy, that's pretty funky. That just doesn't make any sense to me. Right. But that was a long time ago, Edward.
It's worse now.
Yeah.
As my co-guest mentioned, since the beginning of the war on drugs, this became particularly commonly used by jurisdictions and also more broadly used as sort of in a qualitative sense. That is, that in situations where it traditionally would not have been used.
Yeah.
It'll help your guests to really appreciate why this is so controversial. We do have what's called criminal asset forfeiture, which is when someone is convicted of a crime, then the authorities can seize the assets that were directly used in the commission of that crime.
I go to the bank and steal $100,000. They can get that money back from me.
Well, yes, and they could take the gun that you used in some such. But what's controversial about civil asset forfeiture is that there needs to be no proof of guilt on the part of the property owner.
Yes.
So what the government does is it literally files suit against the property rather than a person. And that triggers a fiction that, well, then the person is not really at risk here, which, of course, is absurd because the person's property interests are very much at risk. And as long as authorities can show by a lower standard than a criminal standard, they just preponderance of the evidence that property was somehow connected to a crime, someone can lose millions of dollars, theoretically, in their property interests until they can show that it's not connected to a crime. So it's very perverse.
I mean, that's just jaw-dropping.
Yes.
You know, and Sam, it makes me wonder, why hasn't the Institute for Justice weighed in on this issue long before now?
Well, so in fact, we have. We brought a number of civil forfeiture cases over the past 8 or 9 years. We have a class action lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia, and in an exciting victory, not at the Supreme Court, but this past summer, federal court in one of our cases invalidated the city of Albuquerque's civil forfeiture mechanism on the theory that the profit incentive, the incentive for police and prosecutors to take as much as they could get, was just so strong in the city of Albuquerque that it violated due process.
You know, in your mind, Sam, was there any way this case couldn't have been construed as an excessive fine?
No, I think this is pretty clearly an excessive fine. Professor Cantu is right that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't decide that in today's, or rather this week's decision. Rather, it decided a threshold question of whether this protection in the Bill of Rights applies to the states at all. And now it's really up to the Indiana Supreme Court to answer the next question, namely, well, is this particular forfeiture a violation of the excessive fines clause?
How far back did you go historically, Sam, to show that excessive fines have not been condoned?
About as far back as 1215 with the Magna Carta. And it was gratifying to see that a lot of that the historical research was cited in the opinions as well.
Hmm. Edward, does the Eighth Amendment outline, again, give you any hint as to what's excessive here?
No, which is why I'm employed. It's constitutional. A course in constitutional law is largely a matter of trying to tease out what the framers failed to tell us, including with regard to what an excessive fine means. Generally today, what's applied is called proportionality review, but that just begs further questions. What does proportional mean? Is the fine out of proportion with the nature of the offense?
Well, speaking of of proportional, the Missouri State Auditor just released how much Missouri jurisdictions took in from property seizures last year, $9.1 million. Yes. A million here and a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money, yeah, right?
Yes, yeah. And of course, there was a controversy with Ferguson, Missouri, specifically, according to an investigation by the federal government, of relying excessively on stopping up poor residents of Ferguson and giving them citations for the primary purpose of building revenue for the jurisdiction.
Yes.
So in which, of course, breeds all sorts of contempt for law enforcement in the community, and we see what can happen when we have that kind of contempt.
You know, Edward, both Justices Thomas and Gorsuch wrote separately that the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause might have been the better vehicle for this case. What are they referring to there? Help me understand that.
So I will try to answer this without being too boring and too academic.
Yeah.
It is largely an academic issue because it relates less to results and more to the route we use to get to results. There are three protections that the 14th Amendment provides. One is privileges and immunities, second, equal protection, and third, due process. Now, the equal protection and due process are overwhelmingly the ones that we talk about, primarily because right after the Civil War, in a case called the Slaughterhouse case, the Supreme Court basically read the Privileges and Immunities Clause out of existence. It basically said this clause cannot legitimately be a conduit for the recognition of fundamental civil rights. And so that decision was pretty plainly incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
But the Supreme Court has respected it out of respect for precedent. The more conservative justices now generally argue, look, if we're going to recognize unenumerated or any kind of substantive rights that are imposed against the states, we need to do it through the Privileges and Immunities Clause rather than through the Due Process Clause, which is what we do now. So that's really what that debate is about. It doesn't really relate much to actual end results in this litigation, but it's more academic.
Can you give us a sense, Edward, of how often or how rarely the U.S. Supreme Court overturns a previous ruling it's made?
Statistically, I'm not quite sure what the answer to that is. If I had to guess, I would say roughly once every couple terms.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to talk about what it means to overrule, because I tell my students quite often that the Supreme Court overrules itself implicitly all the time. It expressly does it very rarely. Sometimes it'll just simply ignore a governing precedent because it doesn't like it.
Huh.
That's implicitly overruling it, saying we don't let – Korematsu would be a classic example of this. Do we really expect Korematsu to be treated as this is the famous case where the court upheld the internment of Japanese-American citizens World War II.
Okay.
We wouldn't actually expect the court to treat that as good law, but it's sort of implied, yeah, we're just going to ignore that and sweep it under the rug. Court does that all the time.
Does it do that because it doesn't want to be seen as coming out and contradicting itself too often?
Correct. But the result is even more perverse because instead of being intellectually honest and saying we're just going to overrule this because it was a bad decision, it basically acts as if that bad decision never happened so that it doesn't have to admit that it's contradicting itself.
So bottom line, Edward, the significance of this case is what?
The significance is limited. It opens the door for lower court judges, just like what happened here in Indiana with the trial court, for lower court judges to say, actually, I am to engage in a proportionality review in the context of civil asset forfeiture.
This will give police departments pause all across the country?
I don't know about that. I think we would probably need to see lower courts applying this ruling in a material way that actually limits this power before law enforcement actually gets that kind of message, hey, we need to kind of humble ourselves here and pull back on this. But it is one more mechanism for lower courts to say, this is just not fair.
Sam, do you expect police departments to sort of slow down a little bit when it comes to seizure of property?
I think it would be overly optimistic to think that they would do that in response to this week's decision. But I think this week's decision is an important first step. The majority recognized that there is this perverse danger that police and prosecutors will take property for their own budgets. That's a very real danger. And it's a critical first step to recognize that there are constitutional protections that secure our rights against those kinds of incentives.
Okay, that's the voice of Sam Gedge, an attorney at the Institute for Justice. He was co-counsel on this Timms versus Indiana case we're talking about here. Edward Cantu joined me here in the studio. He's an associate professor of law over at UMKC. Gentlemen, thank you both for a good conversation.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, our film critics join us to talk about the best films now showing, and we'll also talk about the Oscars. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned about the skills employers are looking for these days and what recent high school graduates should consider when thinking about higher education. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, we meet the authorized biographer of Jackie Robinson. We'll learn how the baseball star's life embodied a true American story, even if it wasn't picture perfect. Join us for that Monday on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, it's Oscar time, and about this time every year, the films in the popular short categories are showing around town. That means the Oscar-nominated documentaries, animated films, and live-action shorts. We'll talk about this and the latest independent feature films showing in town, and our critics will give you their recommendations for the best films showing around Kansas City. The film critics are Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And Steve Walker's also with us today.
Thank you, Steven. Yeah.
Okay, all these shorts categories are currently showing at the Tivoli. The Oscar-nominated short, animated, and live-action films are showing at Liberty Hall over in Lawrence. Let's talk about the live-action short films, and I got to be honest with you, too. I'm told these are pretty intense, even difficult to get through. A lot of my neighbors saw them and said, man, that was a rough experience.
We're talking about the live-action shorts, meaning yes. They're not animated and they're not documentaries. They're stories, narrative yes. stories. Four of the five nominees this year are about children in peril and in a variety of different ways. I will say, yes, I agree they are hard to watch, but they're exquisitely directed.
Mm-hmm. So our listeners and potential viewers should be forewarned here.
Be forewarned, yeah. But they're...
Because they're about children in peril, Cindy.
In a variety of different ways, right.
I want to make a point now. We encourage everyone who's interested in attending these short films to go to our local art mm-hmm. houses. The Tivoli and the Fine Arts and Liberty Hall, because the day's going to come when they're not going to be available on local screens. So if we watch them on Netflix, Steve has a long list of all the places you can go to actually watch these films. The live action shorts had been eliminated from. Including cinematography, what was it?
Cinematography, editing, and two other awards.
Costume design, or makeup or something. In my opinion, if they wanted to shorten the Oscars, they should get rid of the shorts completely.
Well, do I have a point, though? I mean, you know, these live-action shorts, even the short documentary films, which I've seen, I mean, these are on topics that are always on the edges of life, where death, kids in peril. I mean, this is pretty rough fare. I'm thinking the palette of life experience extends far beyond those darkest moments of our times. And I'm wondering, come on, filmmakers, let's go.
Well, I saw something different in one of the documentary shorts, Lifeboat, perhaps, than your take on it.
That was a terrific film.
It was a terrific film. It's about... We hear so much about how immigrants are being ostracized and kept out of countries all over the world, including here, including Europe, countries that always used to embrace immigrants. So knowing that and watching these lifeboats full of people trying to come to another place to live made me think about, I am so happy that there are good people in the world who helped them.
Yes.
That's what I took away.
Yeah, and I'm so happy that film was made because you realize, which it's the duh comment, that those are real people in those boats with real emotions
right.
who are suffering in real ways. And that needs, the rest of us need to see that.
Yes,
to understand
absolutely.
What's going on when you read the headlines.
Yeah.
You understand what that looks like and what that feels like.
I think you're right. We need to see them.
And
yes.
Actually, this is the second film in the Refugee Trilogy. And
oh,
remember
it?
Last year, Rescue, or 50 Feet from Syria.
Oh, yeah.
And the same filmmaker, and he's doing this series of films. It's very disturbing. And we have a clip, I guess, a little later from one of the captains.
Are we looking at a time when these shorts are only going to be available at film festivals in years to come? Is that where this is going?
Not this year. This is what Cindy was mentioning. Before I got a link to all of the documentary shorts, I found four of the five streaming on different places.
Oh, really?
Two are on Netflix. One's at The Guardian, the London paper, .com. The Lifeboat can be seen at NewYorker.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they're
well,
available.
Back when there used to be News of the World, there used to be cartoons.
Newsreels. Yeah.
Right. And actually, Tom and Jerry episodes, remember those cartoons?
No.
Well, okay. They received 7 Oscar nominations back when.
Back in the day. Okay.
Back in the day when there were cartoons, animated short films.
Well, let's run down these live action short films, and I should say these challenging live action short films. We'll start with Madre. It's from Spain. It's a psychological thriller about a mother discovering that her son is in danger.
She's on the phone with her 6-year-old boy who's allegedly on vacation with his dad. That was the plan, in another country. And the child begins to say, I don't see dad. I don't know where he is. And, of course, any parent is going to just freak out.
Yes.
And the conversation goes on. And then the kid mentions, there's someone walking towards me. And mother is losing it.
Yes.
It's how short is it? Like
19 minutes.
19 minutes. Boy, it captures a world of fear and outrage in 19 minutes.
Steve, one of the things I bring up every year is the fact that aspiring filmmakers should see every one of these films, because what can be accomplished by the Spanish filmmaker in 19 minutes is more than in half of the movies that pass themselves off as thrillers.
Right.
But again, if you want to reach into the heart and soul of any parent in the country, any worthy parent, this film is going to scare them halfway to heaven, right?
It's pretty harrowing.
And actually, a feature-length version has already been shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, you have to drag me into that one. So, you know, I'm not sure I could do more than 19 minutes of that. There's the second film here in the live-action shorts, Fauve. It's from Canada, 17 minutes. Set in a surface mine, 2 energetic young boys play innocent power games, resulting in tragedy.
The tension throughout this film is palpable. And you know something's going to happen. We're not going to reveal it.
No.
You just know. And these two charming young actors who play these buddies do a terrific job. But again, this is another one of those kids in peril situations that does become very disturbing.
And this is the one I wish I could have seen on a huge screen.
Yeah,
it's beautifully shot.
Well, and again, I'm got a chip on my shoulder here. It's easy to sort of build tension when you put kids in peril. I mean,
yeah, I understand that.
You know, and that's my issue here.
But it can be done, and we've talked about it for other feature length films before. It can be a crutch, and it can be a ploy, and it can be very manipulative.
But you're
I don't
saying
think the, they are.
You
in
think
this
these
case.
Films go beyond
no.
that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The third one, Marguerite. It's about an empathetic nurse who helps an elderly, ailing woman embrace her greatest regret.
It's a delightful film. It's very, very special, very beautiful, very emotional, and very profound. And of all the films that I think I've watched in this category, this is the one that moved me the most.
How about you, Steve?
I thought it was good. Yeah, it was a relief from the children in peril.
Well, there you go. Yeah. The fourth film, Detainment, it's from Ireland, a disturbing reenactment of an actual murder of a toddler by 2 10-year-old boys, and here we go again.
Well, this has gotten a lot of press because the mother of the toddler who was killed in the real case is outraged.
Oh, really?
That this would be made. She was not consulted.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. The movie is from the actual transcript of the police interrogation of these 2 10-year-old boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I can really, that's all I'll say.
And it is a question as to why reenact this? Why make this film, Steve?
How do you answer that, Cindy?
Well, I'm asking this guy.
I mean, what is the artistic...
What's the point?
Goal here of,
I don't know.
Of bringing us this, this kind of...
In this case, I kind of understand why the real mother has a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her worst day, her worst living nightmare is now
being relived.
A 30-minute short film that's up for an Oscar, so you can understand her outrage.
Should it have been a documentary?
That probably so, because these two little kids who were playing the...
And they're quite good.
Yeah, they are.
But if the mother wasn't going to cooperate, that never would have happened, probably.
No, it's a documentary, probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Okay, the final film in this category, again, the live-action short films, is titled Skin. It's about race, hate crimes, and violence passed down from parent to child, and the consequences of indoctrinating children with hatred and racism.
Mm. Yeah, this was tough.
Well, I think we have a clip from this one. Let's bounce off of that.
It's about a little boy whose parents are white supremacists, and in this scene, they've taken him to a shooting range, which is prescient.
Okay, this is from Skin.
$50. One shot, one kill. The young man here shoots that. 100 if he misses. What do you say?
I'll take you up on that.
Yeah, you got it?
I got you. Damn it.
I got that.
All right.
Got you.
Daddy needs Christmas presents.
Just like we trained.
Okay, careful with that, will you?
Okay.
The point of this film, it's a shocking twist at the end. His father beats up an African-American man who he thinks makes a face at his son. He was actually just smiling and saying, hey, at the grocery store. The end point being you reap what you sow in the damage you can do to kids' brains about differences.
Okay, so again, some challenging fare in the live-action short film category. Any sense of which one's going to win? I heard from Cindy that she thinks Marguerite might be the winner there.
Boy, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
That's your job, Steve. You should know these things.
Fava win. It's the most beautifully shot. Yeah.
Okay.
Steve, it always seems that the favorite category is the documentary short films. And that's the case, I think, again, this year. These are the strongest films. For me, the most interesting films.
Yeah, and on the upside, I've seen these films. They take you to a different place, and they show you worlds that maybe you should know something about.
And that's the greatest thing about docs and foreign films.
Couldn't agree
more.
Is that
you spend 2 hours, in the case of Capernaum, which we'll talk about later, you spend 2 hours in the roughest parts of Beirut. When would you ever have that chance?
Yeah.
You know, so.
But we'll talk about it later.
Okay, again, we're talking about the Oscar-nominated short documentary films now as we review some of the best indie films showing on area screens. We'll get to some of the feature-length films in just a few minutes. Cindy, let's go through the docs and the short films here. The first one in this set is Black Sheep. It's about a teenager attempting to destroy his identity as a black person by altering his physical characteristics because he wants to fit in.
It's a very, very disturbing film.
Yes, powerful.
And the family actually moved from one neighborhood because of the violence, and it follows them. Mm-hmm. And the young man who goes to such great lengths to fit in does a phenomenal job of telling the story.
Yeah, the reenactment of this is really very affecting.
Well, and that's why I think it's the weakest by far of the short docs, is because it's so much is restaged with actors. Well, it's not really a documentary.
Let's listen to a clip here from Black Sheep. Do we know what it's about?
He's talking about wanting to fit in.
Okay.
The only way I'm going to survive is if I fit in. If I become like them. So I did whatever I needed to do to fit in to a group of people who hated the color of my skin. If I started with my clothing, I would literally save all my dinner money up, starve myself, literally I'd turn into a little twig just so I can buy all the latest clothing, like Lila Scott, Mackenzie hoodie, tracksuits, and anything I would see all the big top guys wear. That's what I wanted to wear.
So that starts his journey to trying to become somebody else. And it's, again, a challenging topic. The next film in the documentary shorts, Endgame, it's a thought-provoking, insightful film into the end of life and how different people define quality of life at that point in their lives.
Yeah, it's about palliative care and a couple doctors' interesting takes on it. I think in the clip we'll hear what his take on it. It has to do with becoming friends with death And you'll, and I think the clip is really charming and self-explanatory.
This is from Endgame.
Let's talk about that shortness of breath. But the bigger reason to be here today is really to continue to talk through this crazy thing called death.
Yeah, you gave me an assignment.
Yeah.
You told me to make friends with death.
Yeah.
I have failed the assignment.
Yeah, okay.
Failed.
Okay.
I love to live.
Yeah.
I am not accepting this.
Friends with death may be pretty tough. But maybe what I more meant would have been to have some sort of relationship with this subject.
Okay.
It doesn't need to be friendly at all. Just so that it's less scary than this unknown thing in a closet that we never look at, never see, never touch.
You know, I think the scary part is the unknown and the lack of control.
Yeah.
You know, what I liked about this film is that it does challenge you to think, you know, confront death more fully, which is a topic that we dance around and avoid so effectively in our culture. Yeah.
The hospital staff is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a substantial film at 40 minutes.
Yes, it is.
Like Lifeboat, which is also 40 minutes. These aren't 5-minute films.
Right. Yes, okay, so the next film is Lifeboat. It's what we talked about before. It's this very graphic depiction of the plight of Libyans seeking asylum by hopping in lifeboats and traveling across big bodies of water. What about this one?
More than 15,000 refugees have died since 2015 trying to make it to Europe from North Africa in these overcrowded boats. And you do see people suffering. You do see people dying. And you just a captain of one of the ships is very philosophical about his experiences being involved in these rescues. And I think the clip says an awful lot.
Yeah, I agree. It's how he talks about how he humanizes them, unlike some other people.
Okay, this is from Lifeboat.
The further away you are from a problem with humans, the easier it is to rationalize and just see them as a problem. The closer you get to the problem, like a car crash or something, then it's not just a mass of people, then they're separating into individuals. And then they've actually got different expressions on their faces. Then you have to start dealing with them as people. And then your heart starts operating more than your head.
Yeah, boy. And you just can't believe in some cases how crowded these boats are and how terrifying it must be to be in a crowded boat and you don't know how to swim, as so many people don't.
They don't. Yeah.
But how respectful so many of the refugees were to each other. I mean, there was no pushing and shoving, and it was just their patience got them through to land, and some of them never did get to.
They're risking their lives for a better life, and your hat, you can't
hat goes
help
off
but
to
acknowledge.
The
yeah, absolutely.
Rescue workers, for sure.
This next one is the shortest film in the group, and in some ways as memorable as any of them. This is A Night in the garden being Madison Square Garden. It's 7 minutes of a pro-Nazi rally in 1938 in New York City's Madison Square Garden, attended by 20,000 people, and you can't help but wonder the point that's getting made here, Steve.
Well, the point being made is that it's a very prescient film. In a world where, you know, a Nazi rally prompts someone to say there's good people on both sides.
And it's a pro-American rally, and it's supposed to celebrate the rise of Nazism.
There was a story on NPR earlier this week, a couple days ago, with the son of one of the protesters who got up on stage. And remember that scene?
Yes.
They talked to his son.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, listen to a quick clip, but it's you know, Nazi propaganda in New York City.
From A Night in the Garden.
You all have heard of me, through the Jewish-controlled press, as a creature with horns, a cloven hoof, and a long tail. We, with American ideals, demand that our government shall be returned to the American people who founded it.
I want to emphasize, this is 1938 in the heart of New York City.
Right.
It's 20,000 people.
20,000 people.
One of the most diverse cities in the country.
And it puts the hair on end on your head. You just can't believe our own history sometimes. You wonder where the filmmakers, how they came across this incident.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd heard about this maybe years ago, but this is the footage of the actual
it's the real
event and saying the Pledge of Allegiance with Nazi salutes in the air.
Yeah, okay. The final one here in this category, short documentary films, period, end of sentence. This is the most, the lightest topic.
Yeah, it is, oddly enough.
And it's about bringing tampons to rural India. That's what the topic here is.
Well, it's because menstruation in India is very so taboo that young girls are ashamed to even go to school. They're put in menstruation huts in some cases. It's not
and can't afford to buy sanitary products.
So this man invents a sanitary pad machine, and it not only lessens the taboo, but it employs so many women in these little towns.
And empowers them, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It is very heartwarming film.
Okay, let's move on to the final category here, the animated short films. There's a bunch. Maybe we should just kiss them quickly here.
Let's.
Anything you want to point to as a highlight?
I want to point to, it's a very weak category. I didn't care for any one of them.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, wow. Cindy, you feel the same way?
I agree with him. I mean, could have done away with this category this year.
Not so strong for the animated shorts then. Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our film critics about the Oscars, and now we're going to turn to new films showing on screens around town. Here's one that intrigues me, Arctic. The only survivor of a plane crash in the Arctic tundra does what he can to stay alive.
He does what he can.
He can.
But it certainly didn't entertain me.
A perfect movie for snowy days in Kansas City, I'm telling you.
Or the worst kind of movie for a snowy day. I'm not sure which. Yeah. What did you like about it?
Not a whole lot. Mads Mikkelsen.
I like the actor. Sure.
He plays the lead. It's a survival movie, sort of in the tradition of The Gray and The Revenant. Nothing new. There's no new perspective here and no real sense of terror. I don't want to give away too much about,
there's ice fishing, which was semi-interesting to this Midwest person.
Now,
a polar bear to look at, which is cute, but they're fierce and mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much it.
I had never heard of this guy, Joe Pena. He's the director of this film. He's a Brazilian-born YouTube video artist.
Okay.
He's known as Mystery Guitar Man. And I just don't think the guy had what it takes to make an interesting disaster movie like this one.
And there's no clip because there's hardly any dialogue
whatsoever. It's just snow.
It's snow
drifting.
And, snow and more snow.
How about a film you're both, I think at least Steve's high on, Capernaum. A 12-year-old boy survives in the mean streets of Beirut and sues his parents for the crime of giving him life. Cindy?
I think this is one of the best movies of the year. It was the most
moving.
The performances were incredible. Steve?
The director is Nadine Labaki. This 12-year-old runs away from home because his parents are so awful and sell his 11-year-old sister to an older adult male for marriage. He's like, that's enough. And he runs away. He ends up living with this Ethiopian woman, immigrant, and her toddler son. And so, make a long story short, she's working. She puts puts the toddler under the care of the 12-year-old boy, and you kind of watch their relationship, and you're like, how did this filmmaker get these scenes? How does a toddler know what to do? She said, I just let my camera run, and I was very lucky.
Was. And the young actor, Zane, who plays the 12-year-old, has so much charisma and talent. It is mind-boggling.
Film Capernaum, highly recommended at the Tivoli right now.
I just will say, it opens in juvenile court. He's there for a reason. And that's when he says to the judge, I want to sue my parents for being born. And then the rest of the movie is a flashback to what got him there.
It's also the winner of the Grand Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festival.
It's up for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Big thumbs up for Capernaum. How about The World Before Your Feet? It's a film about for the past 6 years, Matt Green has been walking the 8,000 miles of roads and paths in the five boroughs in New York City for
reasons you don't know why.
What a surprise.
He's just doing it.
What an incredible surprise. I learned more about New York than I've ever known. And I think everyone who's ever been there or lives there ought to see this documentary film.
I mean, I've been to New York, you know, 100 times probably. Mm-hmm. And I saw so many different parts of the city that I've never seen. It was he was charming and funny. And yeah, he sleeps on people's couches and cat sits. Because he doesn't work.
But it's a fun film, it sounds like.
Oh, very fun, yeah. And there's, okay. I want to say, there's tonight, and then there's only one more showing tomorrow at the Tivoli at some time during the day.
No kidding. That's The World Before Your Feet. Just got to run out and catch it before it goes. Coming up down the road here, a film everybody knows. A Spanish woman returns to her hometown outside of Madrid with her two children to attend her sister's wedding. The eldest daughter is abducted, and then disturbing family secrets are revealed. This is Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, and this is a film that's getting some
notice.
Yeah,
we've heard it promoted here on NPR. It's a movie that I was truly looking forward to. I'm not going to talk about it too much because it hasn't opened yet. There'll be a sneak preview at some point next week, I think. But
Thursday night at the new
at the Fine Arts. Mm-hmm. Asghar Farhadi did two of my favorite films, A Separation and The Salesman. Hmm. They both won foreign language Oscar awards.
I want to get to Oscar predictions here, but sure. Just a quick note, the 11th annual Kansas Silent Film Festival will be held tonight and tomorrow evening at White Concert Hall over at Washburn University in Topeka. More information, kssilentfilmfest.org. Let's talk about the Oscars and some of the categories we talk about so much on this show. One category, the foreign language film category. Who's going to win it? What's going to win it?
Well, I would say Roma automatically, but I think Roma's going to win Best Picture. Can Roma win both? Is that fair?
Oh,
I think it might happen.
Capernaum, we just talked about. It's up. That would be my pick for
Cindy,
absolute no question.
What's your pick?
I think Roma's going to get Best Picture, and if it does, I do hope Capernaum is
that would be nice. I could live with that. Yeah.
How about the documentary features that includes Free Solo about scaling the face of Yosemite without any ropes?
That's a terrific film.
God, that was a great film.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Just takes you somewhere completely
RBG,
different.
RBG, I think, is...
The Ruth Bader
RBG
Ginsburg
was really popular. The big snub in this category is Won't You Be My Neighbor about Mr. Fred Rogers.
Yeah. How about actor in a leading role? Who do you expect to win it Sunday
God.
Night?
I hope it's not Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody, which is what everyone keeps saying.
Why do you hope
I didn't think the movie was very good.
Oh. No. I agree with you. I'd give it to Willem Dafoe.
For his portrayal of Van Gogh, right?
Van Gogh.
Christian Bale's Dick Cheney is just uncanny.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And that had a lot to do with that category they wanted to get rid of, which is makeup and
Yeah.
How about your prediction for Best Picture? What's going to win? I'm out of time.
Roma.
Roma?
Probably Roma. Yeah.
Should it win?
Yes. Yes, I do think.
No.
It's not the strongest category this year, is it?
I loved Black Panther, and I'm not a Marvel movie person. Yeah. You know that, but I thought it was terrific.
Okay. Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, thank you both very much for coming in today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, yeah.
Yesterday in the show, a UMKC basketball star whose number has been retired. A terrific conversation, and we'll learn about his impact on and off the court. Find that and other episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday, our political panel discusses how Governor Laura Kelly is handling the battle over in the Kansas State House, and we'll get thoughts on the Kansas City mayor's race. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Brian Ellison, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all, and you are up to date.